We're heading to 23 later on. Tomorrow's high 25, 27 by the time we get to Friday and the weekend. I'll remind you that it was 2 weeks ago it was snowing in Ottawa. 2 weeks ago. And now we're into territory where some people will be complaining about the fact it's too hot and everybody will be turning on their air conditioner if you're fortunate enough to have it by this weekend. So anyway, get out and enjoy it.
Well, and we're right into dandelion season, and the Dandelion Festival will be canceled for this year. But I think Ottawa rules the world when it comes to that.
Yeah, you make some dandelion wine if you're looking for something to do. Now to try that instead of the Pinot, yeah, Simmer.
Oh, maybe.
All right, 9:12. Let's talk some football, shall we? Our friend Henry Burris joins us for his usual Wednesday visit. Well, you're going to be homeschooling for the rest of the school year now, my friend. How you doing?
You're right about that, and I'm glad that somebody besides me is aware of Simmer and his love for Pinot. Yeah. So I'll definitely need plenty of that during doing this teaching thing.
Okay. But you bought me the Pinot Gris that time we were at the Sens game. That was the big mistake that was made.
I know. I couldn't believe here we are, just three grown men in a bar before a Sens game, and we're all drinking Pinot Grigio, and everybody else is looking at us like, what is up with that stuff? It's almost like the Budweiser commercial where they're getting rid of all the Bud for celebration, and they're like, hold up, that's what the champagne is for. You don't do it with beer, you know?
You were lesser known at that time, and I think you were introducing yourself in other ways, so it was fun.
Yeah, exactly. I was your bodyguard then, Simmer.
Exactly. All good. All right. Well, listen, we spent some time this morning, and I'm sure you've been, it's been a topic the last couple of days, the Rooney Rule in the National Football League, the effort, or maybe lack thereof, that the league has made over the past several years to try to get more visible minorities into head coaching positions and positions of authority with teams in the NFL. You know, they've talked about now draft pick compensation, Hank, if teams hire African-Americans as head coaches. I mean, you're obviously of African-American descent. You played the game for a long, long time. Just a general thought on what the NFL is thinking about in terms of draft pick compensation now, how you feel about that.
I mean, you know, here in 2020, it's a shame that we're still dealing with those times where, you know, I mean, if you look at the NFL right now, over 70% of the players, you know, are of African-American descent. And you look at the coaching as far as ranks, it's under 20%. And you know, majority of those are defensive coordinators and assistant coaches on top of that. I mean, to the point where you have two offensive coordinators, Eric Bieniemy in Kansas City and Byron Leftwich in Tampa. And then, of course, four head coaches, three of African-American, and Ron Rivera, who's Mexican descent. And then, of course, you only have two GMs. But my thing is, when it comes to relativity and just connectivity, you know, it's a shame that this hasn't happened, because I know there's more than enough qualified coaches that are out there. But you know, I've always heard the impression growing up as a kid, it's more of who you know, not what you know. And that's really what's taking place as far as more so in my mind. And is it a shame that the NFL still hasn't caught up with the times? Yes, it is. But when you talk to a guy who's making $1 billion to $2 billion, $2 billion per year off of these organizations, and you're trying to tell him to change what he's doing, it's kind of hard to make them change, especially with the success that they've had in the NFL. So, I mean, the NFL, it seems like they're trying to change face, change just their focal point, and trying to change the narrative and trying to come up with something. Yes, at first I was angry, because I'm thinking, man, why are we still in this time? Why are we still having to deal with this, especially for, you know, black men and whether it's women or whomever it is who wants to find a job as far as in the coaching ranks, especially if they have all the qualifications. Let's just say I was looking for a coaching job. Why can't I not coach? Because I know a heck of a lot more than a lot of these guys do. But at the end of the day, I mean, to me, I'm glad they did not pass it. And even if they did pass it, you know, for people who are getting upset about this, I'm all about the fact that get in any way you can. If you can find a loophole in the system and help provide opportunities not only for you, but once you get in there and make a name for yourself and establish yourself, bring in others. I mean, that's what it's all about. Somebody has to take one for the team, because all I know is in the game of football and any type of sport, if you get emotional, we've got you beat. And so therefore, you know, me growing up in the world of sports, I'm not going to let anybody allow my emotions to get involved in. I'm going to stay focused on the prize, which is trying to get that job. If I'm that guy who's seeking that job, or that woman who's seeking that job, get that job, improve your status, and help others. But the fact that they tabled it showed they weren't able to get enough support for it. And hopefully with the new rules, we can hopefully get some more minorities and others opportunities to show their net worth and due diligence as far as in the NFL.
Is this, or where it's at right now, Hank, a reflection on basically all white ownership and almost all white general managers?
Well, 100%. I mean, you know, with all the owners being white, and there's definitely plenty of potential black owners out there that definitely have the affordability. But for most of those who've been able to afford it, they probably went the NBA route. Or for some who've, I've known, have inquired about the NFL, they just haven't been passed. And opportunities have been given to others. But then, once again, I mean, opportunities for new franchises in the NFL only come around once every probably 20 years. And so, you know, when the next one does come available, you know, will they give an opportunity for, you know, a black woman or a black man or some minority to have an opportunity to bid in on it and potentially break that seal? I mean, we've already had a black president, so it shows you that we've already came a long ways from what's happened over 400 years ago with slavery. So the thing is, I mean, we came a long ways, but how come probably the most successful business just can't catch up with the times, especially when the money that's being made on the field is being made by guys of the same color of the misrepresentation in the front office and on the sidelines making the calls?
We have, and I did the quick math, I believe, two African-Americans, right, who are coaches in the Canadian Football League, right? Orlando Steinhauer and Kahari Jones?
100% correct.
Yeah. Would you say that overall, and you spent a lot of time up here obviously playing in the league, would you say that the CFL has been more progressive overall than the NFL in its hiring of visible minorities?
I would say so, but you still see the same things taking place, to the fact where, you know, if an African-American coach isn't successful in his job, typically they don't get opportunities as quickly as a lot of your white coaches do. I mean, and that comes from relationship-based also. I'm not going to sit here and say that's a discrimination or a racial profile type thing, but it's more of a relationship thing. But the thing is, most of the time when you see head coaches that have had success of African-American descent, they pretty much are, you know, relegated to probably one of the low-end assistant coaching jobs, or they don't have a position that next year as far as in coaching. Whereas on the other side of things, you typically see, you know, a white coach go from being, you know, not as qualified, let's say like a Ryan Dinwiddie, who wasn't even a coordinator. And even though I thought he was definitely going to be a great candidate, you know, there was still a lot of, you know, there that could have done a great job being a head coach in the CFL. But the thing is, yeah, I definitely see the CFL as being more progressive. You have one GM and two head coaches in a nine-team league. But hopefully, you know, like I said, there's still some room that can be improved in the Canadian Football League as well.
Hank, how do you feel it is at the NCAA? I mean, we're talking about so many African-American players, so many schools. How are the numbers in comparison to the National Football League?
Well, I mean, with over 200 teams in Division I football in NC2A, primarily most of the minorities are still, as far as your assistant coaches, that is, not a lot of head coaches, definitely well under 10% as far as your head coaches. And again, that's another area of concern where it's a shame, because it's all about creating those pipelines, and you hear about that all the time. And I think if you look at the NC2A, you look at CFL, you look at the NFL, and I think it all boils down to one place in my mind, was Kansas City. The two underminds, as far as the two offensive coordinators and quarterback coach who worked under Andy Reid in the past, were Doug Peterson and Matt Nagy, who both have head coaching jobs and were both coaches of the year after they were given their opportunity. But then we saw this past year where Eric Bieniemy, who's an African-American, who's the offensive coordinator, you know, was paraded around in the NFL, you know, for opportunities, but just wasn't given a job. Why is that? You know, he was a part of that same pipeline that's created some impressive minds that have went to other places and have put together an impressive resume and have helped teams and organizations improve. Well, how come he wasn't given a job? Is it the fact that he didn't know people, because the qualifications are there? He's worked with the one guy that people see as the Zen master of creating, you know, future head coaches. So why wasn't he given that opportunity? And instead of a guy named Kevin Stefanski, get Mike Zimmer, who's more of a defensive-minded guy. So, I mean, you look at different things, and that's the same thing that's happened in the NC2A, where there's underrepresentation in the head coaching ranks. You look at athletic directors, who are primarily your GMs, underrepresented, and the same thing goes for, you know, in the CFL. There could be more, but is the opportunity given? Are the incentives there? And it's sad that word has to be used, and that's why it was tabled, because there wasn't enough support in the NFL, but they said table because they hope the discussion goes on and they can find ways to further it, to build more support for it and getting more minorities as far as on the sidelines and their faces in the front offices to make the game well-balanced like it should be.
With Henry Burris, sad as it may seem, is it going to take, because quarterback has always been the glamour position, you know, you played it, and we had for the longest time, it was, you know, black quarterbacks can't play the position because they're not smart enough. There was that stereotype. And finally now, Hank, we're seeing where, you know, we're seeing some of, if not the very best quarterbacks in the National Football League, Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson come immediately to mind, Dak Prescott, you know, of African-American descent. They're great players. They're great players. Is that going to be what's going to change the narrative eventually, is that the players that are playing the marquee position will be seen as, hey, they're not great athletes. They're just great players. They're smart. They're everything you want to be. And eventually that will change the thinking in front offices and in ownership suites.
Well, it has to, because it's getting to the point now where, like you mentioned, where I don't care if you're white or black now. I mean, look at Justin Herbert. I mean, he's a dual-threat quarterback. He's the type of quarterback that can beat you with his legs and with his arm. And the thing is, a lot of these coordinators don't understand that. It's hard to teach a style of game that you haven't coached in the prior 10, 15, 20 years, or when you played during your days, you didn't play that style of football. So it's hard to teach something that you have no idea about. And that's the reason why the changing of the guard and the talk about getting more minority quarterback coaches, offensive coordinators involved to help develop these quarterbacks is such an important, important focus right now, because it's definitely going to be needed. Because who knows how great Dak Prescott could become if he had a guy on his sideline who understands the style of ball that he's played. Lamar Jackson, he's got a great guy there, and Greg Roman. You look at, of course, Andy Reid. I mean, he does a fantastic job with Patrick Mahomes, but there's a number of quarterbacks into the future. This is only the beginning that are going to need guys who can speak the same sheet of music and show them the same type of athletic ability and qualities and how they can develop those qualities as well. And also with the changing of the offensive systems, because there's still a lot of faces that you've seen around the NFL for 20, 30 years now that are still trying to coach these quarterbacks, and they've seen the transition from the tall statue quarterback to now the more athletic style quarterbacks that are getting the job done. In order for the NFL to keep up with times, you can't have a remote control with a black and white TV that you need your finger to turn with, or you need a pair of wire pliers. And right now, that's kind of where the game is at. And so for me, if they want to continue the development of the greatest league in as far as in the world right now, with some of the best players out there playing in it, they need to keep up with that on the sidelines, because it's been well documented that some of the best coaches, and I can even tell you for myself, some of the best coaches I played with were not in the NFL. They were here in the CFL, and that's when I made strides as far as in my game. And it's unfortunate I couldn't have gotten that in the NFL, because you always hear guys say, man, you know, I had great coaching. They never acknowledge the bad coaching, but they say, man, we had some great coaches this year, and that's the reason why my game took off. Why can't we hear that more so? And with the fact that the NFL has been a quarterback-starved game, and now we have an influx of great quarterbacks coming through, great young prodigy quarterbacks and quarterbacks with potential for the future to make the game the best it could ever be, we need the guys there by their side to be working with them that understand that style of play, understand those systems, and actually they can look at them and actually feel more of a connection. And maybe somebody, and I'm not saying this, somebody of the same race or something, but it always helps, especially when it comes to developing young men, as far as to have somebody that's there that can relate with them, not only on the field, but in some way off the field as well.
I've sat down with many a young man who didn't interview well, and perception of the meeting would not be overly intelligent, but was one hell of a hockey player. Is there too much of the process in the National Football League, I'm assuming coach, but more importantly with quarterbacks, that everyone's supposed to sit down and be a Peyton Manning? And I use Lamar Jackson in an interview. Like, how could you possibly watch him and not equate what he does on the field, and maybe not as polished when it comes to actually sitting down for a draft interview?
Oh, you're 100% right. And to see just the number of quarterbacks that went this year that are the non-Peyton Mannings, the non-Tom Brady-type quarterbacks, you know, those not the non-statue quarterbacks. And for example, the one guy who was expected to go late in the first round was Jacob Eason out of Washington, who's known more as that big, strong drop-back quarterback with a strong arm. And he goes in the sixth round of the NFL draft, which was very shocking to a lot of people, because him and Jacob Fromm, more of the quarterbacks that were the dropback style, are being now pushed to the end of the draft, where now the guys who bring those athletic qualities similar to the top quarterbacks in the NFL, because if right now if you put together your top 10, you probably have maybe two quarterbacks, that being Drew Brees and Tom Brady, who are still of that drop back caliber, but the rest are dual threat quarterbacks that can make plays happen with their arm and with their feet. But for the fact that the NFL, yeah, there's still many people still trying to hold on to that. And I know more notably a team like the New York Giants, but thankfully they found a great dual-threat quarterback who, of course, worked with Peyton Manning, who worked with Eli Manning, who was there, and now he's having some success in New York. But there's so many of the old-school style owners that still want to hold on to the bare necessities of what they grew up with, and that being the one marquee position of the quarterback position. But again, with the fact that defensive linemen are that much better, with the fact that secondary is that much better, receivers and running backs aren't finding holes like they once used to. In order for you to put more pressure on a defense, you got to add that extra asset, which is that quarterback who can now tuck the ball and run and make things happen. Because right now, the most successful quarterback at winning, regardless of who he's had around him year in and year out, has been Russell Wilson. And he's a guy who can not only beat you with his arm, when they put a bunch of young rookie receivers and DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett around them, he still helped that team get to the playoffs. But now he can also beat you with his feet, just as he's done his entire career. And that's the future of quarterbacking in the NFL.
All right, good stuff. I wanted to ask you one other question on a completely different topic. Over the weekend, there was a podcast that came on, Adam Schefter's podcast. And they're talking about the NFL is working with Oakley on a device, Hank, that would be similar to a mask that would be similar to the N95 mask that the healthcare workers are using right now, that would somehow fit over a football helmet. And I don't know if it's right up to the face or would be over the bars or whatever, but that would that they would think in some way would be able to mitigate some of what they're looking, obviously, in the middle of the corona crisis, the spread of that illness potentially to play football. Is that doable when you think about that? Like to wear, let's say, a form-fitting mask tight to your face and nose and play the game of football still?
100% it is. I remember in college I wore a similar mask because I wore contacts when I played football. So it was it's pretty much a clear shield that, of course, at the time came down to the top of your mask, but now they're looking at some that can actually fit in even behind the mask. So just in case if anybody were to cough or, any fluids were to be exchanged that way, they want to have as much protection for the face as possible. And it is highly possible. The problem is, with some of the hard hits, how are they going to be able to, carry out some different examples of what that impact is like just to see if this mask can withstand those blows that are taken. But to me, the hard part is if I'm a 350-pound guy and it comes training camp, and you're in that 100-degree heat in Houston, Texas, or in Miami, Florida, or down in Phoenix, Arizona, it's hot behind those masks. And so good luck to those guys trying to wear that or to convince these guys who've never done it before to put these masks on. It's excruciating hot, and you got to take the helmet off when you're sweating. Everything builds up the humidity. It fogs up as far as the glass does or the hard plastic or whatever the material is. But they're going to have to do a lot of persuading. But, again, in these times, guys are going to have to understand that these steps are going to have to be taken just to protect people. And they've already came out and said that regardless of how much we try to protect our players, some players will test positive. So right now, the biggest, the biggest discussion needs to be what are the next steps that are going to be taken once that first guy does test positive, and what are going to be the steps for the rest of the league instead of things melting down the way it did when the NBA happened, where there really wasn't a protocol set at that time. So, right. But yeah, you could see guys wearing shields to protect themselves. They're trying to do any and everything they can to protect the players.
Well, you get some pretty funky designs in there, couldn't you?
Can really go crazy.
Sounds like a sales opportunity. You got Budweiser put right across the top, right? The NFL likes to look for a buck or two in everything. You may know that.
100% everything they do.
All right, good stuff. Always appreciate the insight, my friend. Thanks for the time, and look forward to chatting again with you next week.
Hey, guys, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
All right, there goes Henry Burst joining us in the Gabriel Pizza Hotline, brought to you by Pizza Perks at Gabriel Pizza. Download the Gabriel Pizza Perks app and sign up today. And so there you go, Simmer. And you and I kind of scoffed at the idea yesterday about this. Yeah. And this is without actually seeing it. I haven't even seen a prototype.
Yeah.
But Henry Burris said, look, I kind of played with something sort of similar, and he thinks it's doable.
Yeah, so. I guess you see what it looks like. But also to that, like I understand where we're going, but if you've been around a football locker room, and college is different than the pros, but what is the roster in the National Football League? Is it 52 men?
Well, active on game day, it's, I think, 46, I believe it is.
Like your thought process, if you've ever seen one of those locker rooms of what's going on, like we're not just talking about a guy going hopping his stall. Like you're talking about all these guys getting taped up before a game, right?
Right.
All the prep that they're getting. How are you going to handle the massage people that have become such a big part of athletics? I just don't think a lot of these protocols, honestly, if you want to play the sports, especially contact sports, good luck on that. What you're really just going to have to do is say, how can you control the environment? How do you handle testing? And is it the EPL ended up doing, 790 tests and six tested
positives? Six positives, yeah.
You know, that to me is just more real. Now, try to do the best you can, but man, behind the scenes, we're not talking practice anymore, rolling into the rink with your gear on. Football player's not coming in his cleats and to go home and shower after, I don't think. So, but hey, if you can try it and move forward, but I still think the heat would be a big issue.
Mm. All I know is this, watching last year that my Philadelphia Eagles cornerbacks were practicing physical distancing from any receivers they're trying to cover. They were ahead of their time.
No, I know a number of hockey players in the past that would have been excellent. And you think of poor Inge Hammerstrom, those types, eh?
Yeah.
Be excellent in today's world.
All right, we'll take a break at 9:32. Come back with much more here on a Wednesday morning. You are listening to Sports Radio TSN 1200. Wednesday, we got another World Junior game revisited tonight. It's the 2015 gold medal game. Canada-Russia. This is Connor McDavid, Anthony Duclair, Nick Paul, Curtis Lazar, all on that team. I'll spoil it for you because, well, you remember, Canada won gold for the first time since 2009 here in Ottawa. So it had been a long drought, and the game was played in Toronto, so everybody was upside down and everything was pro-Canadian. Typically, it is at the World Juniors. Anyway, yeah. But the other part of it was Canada had a huge lead in that game, 5-1. And the Russians got a bunch of goals, I think, in the third period to make it 5-4. It turned into what was a laugher, a nail-biter. But Canada wins. Spoiler alert, but we'll have the game for you tonight. 7 o'clock here on TSN 1200.
Yeah, and funny, if you look at that, I guess this year with Lafreniere being a late birthday, how rare is it where a draftable player is a star? And you've talked about the star, you know, the lack of star power at times. Most of these high-end players are okay in the tournament, and then they get drafted like a Sidney Crosby, and you're off to the NHL, right? So rare year to have that, and last year to have it with Lafreniere.
Yeah. Although, you know, sometimes with the European players, right? The one that pops out to me is Finland, right? They had the year with Laine, and well, at that point, Puljujärvi was seen as a top prospect,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
We're both in the tournament, and they were as 17-year-olds, right? In their draft year.
And Austin Matthews must have been in the United States, and Eichel, but I guess just from the Canadian side of it, say, and a lot of the guys go on to be great players, but they're not necessarily identified, and especially when you're trying to sell it here in Canada, couldn't have come at a better time with playing in Connor McDavid's hometown.
Unsigned Texan at 12-1200. Hey, boys, I hear Filip Kuba is looking to make a comeback in the NHL with no contact. That's right up his alley. It comes from Unsigned this morning. Well, that's you know what, Filip Kuba in his time beside Erik Karlsson was actually a pretty effective player.
Well, and got the retirement contract and went to Florida with it. He was a nice compliment. Good on Ottawa that summer when they lost him to turn around and make the Mark Methot trade where you're trying to find the right fit. Hey, we know it is Erik Karlsson, but both Kuba and Mark Methot were very good partners for him.
Joel writes, Mike Tomlin and Brian Flores, black coaches who want to win and are paid to win and get to hire their own coaches, both have white offensive, defensive coordinators and special team coaches. Okay. Anthony Lynn has a white offensive and defensive coordinator. If a black candidate was a better choice, do you not think they would get hired? That comes from Joel.
You know what, Joel? I just love to get Henry Burris on, and I'm not trying to make an excuse. I come from a sport that is so dominantly white. Like, everything is white. Everything is North American. In football, I think back to really Doug Williams and the stuff that he went through, but I can't even imagine, even as a collegiate quarterback, you're the star of the team, and everybody around you is second-guessing you because of the color of your skin. So, obviously, and the one thing that I took from Henry Burris is that I wasn't aware of, JR, the idea that there's a feeling that they're trying to block black ownership in the National Football League, to me, takes that to another level, right? You know, that to me, wow. And I knew it's a white league, and I know the way the mentality is, and you got the old school owners. But I thought, wow, that would really scare me if I'm a sport, if that really is what's going on behind the scenes.
It really is. I mean, and maybe I'm naive to a lot of things. The reinforcement of how big a role. And listen, I know in Canada it's an issue as well, and we certainly have our issues with racism, and especially involving the native population. But boy, oh boy, the race just, for lack of a better term, colors everything in the United States still to this day. It's amazing.
Yeah, and I can't remember who it was in the National Football League, but the analogy to me was so incredible that you have, and it was just not a stereotype, but one talking about a lot of the African-American players have been raised by a single mother. And the single mother has worked predominantly for a white owner. And the way they're treated and perceived, that's exactly what is brought over by the young athlete that's seen this his whole life, is that you're going into this sport and you're being treated, at times they've used that term, like slaves. Now, the compensation obviously isn't that, but that's a lot of the mentality. And again, I love these issues and I love to talk about it. I just love to hear, to get a better understanding what each athlete kind of views and why it is like that in the United States.
Yeah. I just want, you know, and Hank talks about, black ownership. And I guess at the end of the day, that will ultimately, if it reached that stage, would ultimately perhaps prove to be the solution to this issue. But I just wonder, I raise the question of, You know, for the longest time, we had blacks couldn't play quarterback weren't smart enough, right? And now we're seeing, you know, tons of it. And I brought up Lamar Jackson and Patrick Mahomes, and he brings up, well, those guys are recent. We're talking about Russell Wilson has been arguably, in terms of the last, 7 to 8 years?
Yeah.
Overall, the length and breadth of that time, been one of the best two or three quarterbacks in all of football. That stereotype is well in the rearview mirror. Yeah. And I wonder as we get, you know, more and more, black quarterbacks and being successful, whether that gets further and further in the rearview mirror, that old way of thinking, and whether that is going to eventually kind of people go, you know what, those stereotypes are just, you know, they're not worth anything. Let's hire the best person.
Yeah.
You know, blacks are smart enough to play quarterback. Blacks are smart enough to be head coaches in the NFL.
Yeah, I'd actually, if I was a National Football League from an ownership standpoint, something I think you could really take a run at, because I'm respectful when you sit down and you want to hire a coach. Hey, you know what? It shouldn't be. It's just a comfort level for the person. I'll tell you what will change in a hurry. You got to get more black general managers. Like that relationship, and I'd hate to also see a qualified white person not get a job they deserve, but to me, that's where, if I'm the NFL, that I'd be taking more of a run at who are the decision makers. If I can't change out the owner, if I've got more African-American general managers, I'll guarantee I'll have more coaches.
Did he say two black general managers in the NFL?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think he, I don't want to say he danced around it. I think what you also understood here, and I'm one of those ones that's always talking about Canada and how easy it is, and we're not like the United States. Well, I think he really pointed out the CFL is not a whole lot better, right?
Yeah. Although, yeah. And listen, I'm not here to argue with him. He knows firsthand from having come up here and played in the game. But I listen, as far as leading the way of having, first of all, African Americans play the position of quarterback, were way ahead of it in the CFL. But also, if I were to look at it, and it's anecdotal, it's in my head, but I think we've had far more black head coaches in the Canadian Football League per capita than they have had in the NFL.
Yeah.
I don't think there's much doubt about that.
No, and also you'd also get into a mix of nationals versus internationals, right? When it comes to employment, and for a lot of former players, you'd have to go through this. I mean, how many actually want to go down south and they're actually pursuing coaches at the professional collegiate level in the U.S., right?
Right.
Like for a lot that end up going home, but it is. And like I said, I go back to some of the, you know, for Condridge Holloway, and you see that story about playing at the University of Tennessee and you're the star player and you want to play in the NFL. For him, now the salaries at the time I think were pretty comparable, but to say, nope, I'm not going to be a receiver, I'm going to go up and play in the Canadian Football League, and had a hell of a career for himself.
All right, 9:47. We touched on this earlier this morning, but Horace Grant, former Chicago Bull teammate of Michael Jordan, needless to say, he's not seeing necessarily eye to eye with his former teammate over the documentary, which just finished up this past weekend, The Last Dance, which he called a so-called documentary. Here is Horace Grant speaking yesterday on Chicago radio with his thoughts on the documentary as a whole.
I would say, you know, entertaining, but, you know, we know who was there as teammates, that about 90% of it was I don't know if I can say it on air, but BS.
Right.
In terms of the realness of it, you know, as I stated the other day, that it wasn't real because a lot of things that he said to some of his teammates, that his teammates went back at him, but all of that was kind of edited out of the documentary, if you want to call it a documentary.
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, it's television, right? And it's got to be entertaining. So, the counter argument to that would be, hey, listen, this is told from Michael Jordan's point of view, whether you want to call it a narrative or a so-called document, whatever you want to ascribe to it. But I found that interesting to say that he says 90% of it is BS, which you saw the representation.
Yeah, and I would think, if I'm Scottie Pippen, I think Phil Jackson, you're at a different point in your career. You moved on, you retired, you've done other great things. If you wanted somebody to be a part of a documentary, I would think you'd like to have an opportunity to watch it at the end and have the ability to maybe edit some of it. Because if you watch it, you certainly think, from Phil Jackson to Scottie Pippen to certainly Jerry Reinsdorf, everybody was on board and for the most part loved Michael Jordan. And I didn't think they shied away from
the standards that he had. Everybody, including Steve Kerr, you know, seemed to be more than willing to sit down. But I also understand, oh man, and you have to be careful now. Where Horace Grant is at, I don't know what he does for a living. Like you have to be careful to attack a Michael Jordan, right? Like, how many people in the golf world have learned that, hey, you want to take a run at Tiger Woods? Good luck next time you need an interview.
Right.
Or in this case, even if you need a job. Also, surprisingly, no Shaquille O'Neal, very little Charles Barkley. Like, I thought there would have been some other characters maybe that would have got interviewed a little bit more.
Well, he and Charles are on the outs, right? So you wonder whether Charles was asked and declined to interview for it. The other part of it is, listen, if we're nitpicking, I'll start by saying, and I haven't watched the last two episodes yet, but I found it completely entertaining. And it's been a great diversion with what we're going through right now. I mean, I'm glad we had it than not had it.
Yeah.
If we're looking at it, was it an all-encompassing look at Michael Jordan? Well, no, because I would have quite frankly liked to have heard from his family more. I would like to heard from his, I don't know if he and his ex-wife get along any longer, or if they're, you know, if she has a quote axe to grind or anything like that. His kids were never interviewed. Now, they were interviewed the next day, but you know, what was Michael Jordan like as a family man? Right. Was he an absentee father? What was he? That part of it, correct me if I'm wrong. There was nothing to that whatsoever as part of that documentary.
No, for sure. And I guess that's part of where the footage is behind the scenes. I will, and I'm not to defend, but the footage wasn't Michael Jordan on cribs, right? All of this was professional footage, and I'm sure, that he wanted to keep it to that. But you could go through any athlete and kind of break it down, and that's where it's hard.
But that's where part, you know, if we're talking about, you know, what made Michael Jordan everything that he was, that's part of the puzzle.
Oh, for sure.
Right?
The home life,
he interviewed his mother, and I understand that whole part of it. That's him growing up, but we didn't see Michael Jordan the man.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree.
We saw Michael Jordan, the basketball player.
Yeah.
Right?
No, for sure. No, there's a reason, I guess, that was sitting there as long as it was. He didn't want to delve into that, open up anything to do with the death of his father, the link to gambling, some of the other things. No, you could, you know, dive a little deeper. I would also say in a 10-part series, though, that I thought he was very upfront and very honest. And I didn't, like you say, is he going to come in there and wreck himself as a brand? Like, we're talking about a guy now that still generates millions and millions of dollars. Why would you want to tarnish that? And you're kind of, would you agree you're doing somebody a favor? Like, I don't know if, did Michael Jordan really benefit from this?
I think the Jordan brand is bigger and stronger than ever. Are you kidding? He's dominated the sports landscape for the last five weeks, but did he need
the documentary, I guess, is my point. Like, Michael Jordan...
No, he's worth $2 billion already.
Air Jordan was dominating and will continue. Now, I'm not saying it hurt him, per se, but all I'm saying is that he could have just said, no, we're not doing it. You know what? I'll leave it on the shelves. Mm-hmm. At least he came out and was willing to spend an awful lot of time. And I mentioned last week, but that house that he's in too, they wouldn't allow him to go in his own home. So you touch on that. They had to rent that house in...
They rented three different houses.
Down in the Florida area where he said, no, not going to do it. Showed him with his cigars and his drink, but not allowed to be in his house, not allowed to show the family, and not allowed to be on the plane.
If you missed it and you want to watch again, maybe you don't have access to Netflix, you're one of the few people. Of course, that's how you could watch it in Canada. ABC is actually going to start showing it again beginning on Saturday nights, beginning this Saturday night for the next five weekends. Two episodes per Saturday starting this weekend. If you want to watch it again or you want to watch it for the first time, The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan documentary. We'll take a break at 9:52. Come back with a final segment when we return here on TSN 1200. Welcome back, 9:58. By the way, our highest scoring birthday boy born today on this May the 20th. He would have turned 80 years old today. Passed away a couple of years ago. 20 seasons, so only played for one NHL team. Late 50s to the late 70s was his time frame of playing. Born in Europe. You've probably seen him on your social media today.
No, I haven't.
Won a Stanley Cup. This was maybe the most interesting thing. He had over 100 penalty minutes in a season four times early in his career and ended up winning the Lady Bing twice later on in his career.
The switch goes on. Is it terrible, Ted?
No, it's not.
Oh, okay.
No.
Who do we got?
Stan Mikita.
Oh, darn it.
Stan Mikita. And my final clue was featured in the Wayne's World movies, right?
Oh, Stan Mikita donuts.
Yes, exactly. Stan Mikita.
Not Tim Hortons, but Stan Mikita.
Yeah.
actually born in Czechoslovakia? What was it? Any backstory of defecting, or did they just move?
You know
there?
What? I didn't end up looking how he ended up, because he played in St. Catharines, his junior hockey in St. Catharines. I didn't know how he ended up here, but. The rest, as they say, is history. One of the greatest Chicago Blackhawks of all time. Won a Stanley Cup back in 1961, which was the last one they won before they won again in 2010. All right, that'll wrap it up for us. Don't forget, Eric Macromella is back tonight at 6 with Offside. And then we've got that World Juniors Revisited, Canada-Russia. Great game, 2015 gold medal game tonight for you at 7. Ian and Steve are on the drive this afternoon at 2, and the Dan Patrick Show will follow. Have a great day, everybody. And we'll chat tomorrow on TSN 1200.
Time has expired. There's the Hooter.
Let's go to eat a damn snack.